Chapter 11. Oumuamua's Wager. Imagine life on our planet the day after there is irrefutable confirmation of life elsewhere in the universe. Briefly entertain the hypothetical idea that Oumuamua had been discovered before October 2017 and that we had the opportunity to launch a spacecraft with a camera that snapped a close-up photo of Oumuamua at nearest approach and demonstrated beyond a reasonable doubt that this object was technological debris from an extraterrestrial civilization. Now, ask yourself, what would have followed? Finding evidence of life on another planet, I believe, would have a profound impact not just on the science of astronomy, but on human psychology, philosophy, religion, even education. Whereas at present, only a small minority of the scientific community seriously studies the probability of and search for extraterrestrial life, these subjects will become part of our mandatory high school curriculum the moment we know for a certainty that we are not alone. It is not too much to presume that such a discovery would also affect the way we behave and how we interact with each other, because we might come to feel as though we are a part of a single unified team, humanity, and stop worrying and warring over mundane issues like geographical borders and separate economies. Such a discovery would change us in both fundamental and subtle ways, and I have to imagine that most of them would be for the better. Given the ubiquity of habitable planets, it is the height of arrogance to conclude that we are unique. It is, I believe, the hubris of a young age. When my daughters were toddlers, they believed they were special. But after meeting other children, they developed a new perspective of reality, and they matured. In order for our civilization to mature, we need to venture into space and seek others. Out there, we might discover that not only are we not the only kids on the block, we are also far from the smartest kids on the block. Just as we once gave up on the belief that the Earth was at the center of the universe, so must we start to act from the clear, statistical likelihood that we are not intelligent, sentient creatures without peer. Not only are you and I personally going to be intellectually eclipsed by future generations, but humans are the sole creators of a civilization no more, and we are very likely a great deal less accomplished than what the universe has already witnessed. Such a framework of understanding will endow us with a sense of modesty, and modesty will improve our perspective on our place in the universe, which is frailer than we tend to believe. And that could increase the chance we endure. Because with every day that goes by, we are gambling with our civilization's fate, and at the moment, the odds that it will last seem long indeed. Think of it as Oumuamua's wager, a bet along the lines of the one proposed by the 17th century French mathematician, philosopher, and theologian Blaise Pascal. He framed his famous wager this way. Humans bet with their lives on whether God exists or not. It is better, Pascal argued, to live a life as though God does. Pascal's reasoning ran as follows. If it turns out that God doesn't exist, you have only given up a few pleasures during your lifetime. If God does exist, however, you gain heaven, and with it, an infinity of rewards. You also avoid the worst of all possible outcomes, an eternity in hell. In much the same way, I would argue, humanity bets its future on whether Oumuamua is extraterrestrial technology or not. And while our wager is thoroughly secular, its implications are no less profound. In a very tangible sense, the promise of betting right, of exploring out among the stars for the life we expect to find there, are the heavens themselves. And especially when we consider the specter of the great filter and the fact that civilizations with the technological prowess to explore the universe are also highly vulnerable to annihilation by self-inflicted wounds, betting wrong and planning too little and too late could hasten our extinction. These two wagers are, of course, vastly different in some important ways. For instance, Pascal's wager requires a giant leap of faith. Oumuamua's wager requires only a modest leap of hope, specifically hope for more scientific evidence. That could be something as simple as a single, close-up, high-resolution image of an object we have already managed to photograph from afar. Pascal's eternal cost-benefit analysis required him to posit a divine, omniscient being. To posit that Oumuamua is extraterrestrial technology requires only the belief in an intelligence other than our own. What's more, whereas Pascal had faith and faith alone, we have evidence and reasoning, assets that shorten the odds in favor of Oumuamua having been extraterrestrial technology. There is another reason I find the comparison of these wagers instructive. I have learned that conversations about Oumuamua often veer into the religious. I believe this is because we understand that any sufficiently advanced intelligence will appear to us as a good approximation to God. Have your religious beliefs or beliefs about God changed in any way in the time you have been studying astronomy? When a New Yorker journalist interviewing me about Oumuamua asked me this, I was initially perplexed. Why make the assumption that I am religious? I was and remain secular. But I began to appreciate where this line of questioning had stemmed from during an interview with CNN. Toward the very end of our allotted time, the interviewer asked me, "In our first encounter with extraterrestrial civilization, would we hope they be religious or secular?" Perhaps realizing it allowed for no one-sentence answer, he added that, given the time constraint, I needn't provide my answer. I think I do need to. And more important, I believe we need to think more than we have about the wellsprings of this sort of question. Oumuamua presents us with an awesome possibility, and we have traditionally struggled with awe. Over centuries, our civilization has invented means, from myths to the scientific method, to make sense of things that inspire awe in us. And with the passage of time, many such things have moved from the miraculous column of human experience over to the mundane. Much of this can be attributed to advances in the sciences, but no discipline of thought is free of the risk of dogmatic blinders, and this is true for scientists as well as theologians. Consider how a secular person would hear the question posed to me by the CNN interviewer. He might briefly allow that, on the one hand, religious beings are more likely to be ethical, guided by noble values, perhaps, or holding to some injunction that the meek should inherit the universe. After all, most of humanity's religions teach abstract value systems that followers obey, whether out of fear of punishment by a divine entity or out of social interests. A secular person might even grant that a small number of religions, such as Jainism, explicitly espouse nonviolence. But, this person will point out, even the briefest survey of our religious history should give one pause. To pick an example at random, recall the 16th century Spanish invasion of Central and South America. Fueled by a hatred of idolatry, in 1562, the Roman Catholic priest Diego de Landa Calderón burned in a grand auto-da-fe thousands of Mayan manuscripts or codices, destroying so many that next to none remain for today's scholars to study. "We found a large number of books in these characters," the priest declared, "and as they contained nothing in which were not to be seen as superstition and lies of the devil, we burned them all." If we imagine that our first encounter with extraterrestrials or their technology will replicate the Inquisition of the Roman Catholic Church and the practices that followed Hernan Cortes's 1519 arrival in Tenochtitlan, the capital of the Aztec Empire, we would be right to be concerned. But consider how a religious person is likely to respond when asked, "In our first encounter with extraterrestrial civilization, would we hope they be religious or secular?" Without question, the sciences, including the social sciences such as economics, have steadily increased life expectancy and reduced extreme poverty. But the presumption that we would obviously prefer a civilization that is secular and scientific raises equally well-worn concerns. Consider a recent century, the 20th. Both World War I and World War II, among the most lethal conflicts in all of human history, were secular contests over borders, resources, and power. During that same century, eugenics, the supposed science of controlling human propagation for its improvement, lent false credence to racism in the United States and encouraged the Holocaust in Nazi Germany. Then, too, the 20th century's most boastfully secular experiment, the Soviet Union, frequently demanded that scientific advances conform to communist ideological tenets. Clearly, science, too, is susceptible to orthodoxy, authoritarianism, and even violence. The difficulty rests, I believe, in the question the interviewer posed. He took the wrong lesson from the evidence supplied by the one civilization available for study, our own. At the scale of an entire civilization, religious or secular is liable to be a false dichotomy. Judging by human history, both recent and distant, any alien intelligence we encounter is likely to be both religious and secular, and that isn't necessarily a cause for concern. Cast your mind forward once more to the day after we find proof of life elsewhere in the universe. There is one more prediction I feel confident in making. When we learn for certain that we are not alone in the universe, all of humanity's religions and all of its scientists, even the most conservative, will find ways to accommodate the fact. My hope is not that the first extraterrestrial intelligence we encounter be either religious or secular, but rather that it be animated by humility rather than arrogance. This would qualify the encounter as a mutual learning experience that enriches both parties rather than a zero-sum conflict propelled by self-interests and followed by a power struggle for domination. This hope extends, of course, to the way we should engage in space exploration as we approach distant outposts and as we consider establishing our own settlements, our own little Beit Hanans among the stars. As we proceed farther into the universe, our moral responsibility and humility should follow higher standards than those demonstrated so far on Earth. In humanity's case, both religion and science have, over the course of our history, bolstered both our humility and our arrogance. It is the height of arrogance to rule out what can be rationally considered. But that is the work of all intellectual blinders, whether they're manufactured by theologians or scientists. Both fields have, on occasion, encouraged their practitioners to don such blinders, restricting their thoughts and forcing them to follow the well-worn traces of existing lines of inquiry. It must also be admitted, however, that both science and theology have, on occasion, encouraged pockets of their practitioners to do the opposite, to shed their blinders and open themselves up to the new, the controversial, the unexpected. This is where I find cause for hope. First, it is probable that the members of any extraterrestrial civilization will be as awed to encounter us as we are to encounter them. They, too, will likely have stared out into the abyss of space for countless generations. They, too, will understand that the universe teems with planets capable of supporting life, and yet life in the universe seems exceptionally rare. Second, it is quite possible that they will worry about their reception by our species as much as we may worry over their intentions. Whatever information they have concerning life on Earth, it will be partial and much of it terribly out of date. Just as terrestrial astronomers look back into time when they look out into space, so do extraterrestrial astronomers. The laws of physics, after all, will apply to our alien counterparts' technologies no less than they apply to ours. And based on everything we have learned to date, This suggests that the distances traveled will encourage modesty. Consider that all of humanity's interstellar vehicles are doomed to one-way journeys. The same will likely prove true for the extraterrestrial. Third, I have to imagine that among the alien intelligence we eventually encounter, there will be a few existentialists. I don't think that is a fantastical concept. Just as the intellectual history of humanity allowed the existential school of thought to flourish on Earth, informing what came after it, I suspect the same will prove true for alien intelligence. I believe that they, no less than us, will have spent a civilization's lifetime confronting life's most stubborn mysteries, the ones that are impossible to move from the miraculous to the mundane. There is no mystery more fundamental than the meaning of life. Some of us are cast in the role of Hamlet, some of us in the roles of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, but all of us experience the sensation of striding across a stage without a script. It is the rare human, and I suspect sentient being, who never seeks an answer to the question, "What's it all about?" Early in my life, I turned to the existential philosophers, especially Albert Camus, for guidance. Among his works, one that resonated with me was The Myth of Sisyphus. According to Greek mythology, Sisyphus was punished by the gods and forced for all eternity to roll a heavy boulder up a hill, only for it to roll back down once he managed to get it nearly to the top. Camus believed that this was analogous to the absurd condition of man, who was likewise caught in a perpetual cycle as he tried to understand an inexplicable world. Sentient life's common circumstance to live and die without ever learning why was, Camus believed, absurd. I believe that other sentient beings, who are bound by intellectual limitations just as we are, will inevitably arrive at the same conclusion. Life is absurd. It is difficult to remain arrogant in the face of the absurd. Humility is the more apt posture. The more we see evidence of humankind cultivating humility when confronted with the awesome, the more we have reason to anticipate the same from extraterrestrial civilizations. Over our history, humans have repeatedly sought to fight for causes that were more inspiring than their private lives, usually causes having to do with terrestrial concerns, such as nationality and religion. To take another example, chosen at random, during the Second World War, Japanese soldiers were willing to sacrifice their lives for the sake of their Emperor Hirohito. But in view of our recent realization that there are approximately a zeta, or 10 to the 21st power, of habitable planets in the observable universe, the emperor's status cannot be more significant than that of an ant hugging a single grain of sand on a huge beach. And what is true of an emperor is no less true for a soldier or anyone else on Earth. We would do well to look up and look beyond that grain of sand. Perhaps, rather than behaving like outsized actors in puny roles, we should adopt the perspective of spectators and simply enjoy the dazzling show all around us. And in the broad spirit of stopping to smell the roses or inspect the seashells, there is much for the spectator to enjoy, both on Earth and off it. If the rich spectacle of events on our planet is insufficiently inspiring, we can use our telescopes to witness an even wider variety of dramas. Within the next decade, the Vera C. Rubin Observatory, conducting the Legacy Survey of Space and Time, a 10-year effort to repeatedly photograph more than half of the night sky, will deliver 500 petabytes of images from our cosmic environment. I dream that one of the survey's results will be a new streaming media subscription service. This one, broadcasting the entire universe. Not all of us can remain spectators, of course. Some of us will aspire to make a difference. The ways to contribute, and I will always argue that no pursuit holds as much promise of contribution than the sciences, are myriad. But it will help if we give ourselves an objective commensurate with our capacity to wonder and to hope. Pondering the values of other civilizations ultimately allows us to understand and refine our own. The effort also captures the promises of Oumuamua's wager. Bet that humanity has recently brushed with extraterrestrial technology, and we fundamentally shift what we seek and what we expect to find out in the universe. Similarly, we shift those things we could aspire to undertake that would make a difference, not just to our world, but to the universe at large. Live as if we know there is or has been intelligent life in the universe other than our own, and we redefine some of the missions of humanity. Personally, I have always been driven by the desire to understand something new about the universe that would change our cosmic perspective and stimulate our aspirations for space. I assign a meaning to my life by using the spectator perspective of an astronomer to motivate new challenges for our civilization on the cosmic stage. Given our many engineering accomplishments on Earth, a broader perspective could lead us to develop new technologies, ask new questions, establish new disciplines, and see our role in a larger habitat. Among all astronomical data, the discovery of alien life could have the greatest impact on our broad outlook. And what if we have already made that discovery? What if, like so many of science's brushes with insights that profoundly change how we see the world around us and our place within it, the only thing preventing us from adopting that broader outlook is our own reluctance to accept optimistically Oumuamua's wager? The main benefit from an encounter with superior beings would be the opportunity to ask them the fundamental question that has been bothering us for ages. What's the meaning of life? I hope to live long enough to be around for their answer, stemming from numerous millennia of acquired scientific knowledge. But at the same time, I worry that the pace of humanity's advance to the answer will be hampered by our arrogance, which has often made it easier for us to cling to our grain of sand rather than look up into the expanse of stars.
Chapter 12. Seeds. If, when confronted with Oumuamua's wager, we decide to bet on the object being the product of extraterrestrial intelligence rather than simply a weird rock, that raises another question. How much are we willing to place on this wager? For starters, consider the least ambitious bet humanity could make. We could simply accept that we missed an opportunity to properly examine the first interstellar traveler that humankind ever spotted and resolve to be better prepared in the future so as not to miss the next one. Preparation could proceed along several tracks, including coming up with a way to capture an image of the next wildly anomalous object that passes through our solar system, perhaps even to capture the object itself. But preparation would also entail increasing every capacity, intellectual and technological, to be able to study and make sense of what we find. The results of such a modest bet are staggering to contemplate. The discovery of another civilization's technology might help us reach goals that we have long aspired to. Astroarchaeology would be one such initiative, but our efforts shouldn't stop there. Take seriously the hypothesis of Oumuamua's alien technology origin, and we must also take seriously the challenges that we are likely to face in our next encounter with extraterrestrial technology or life. Once we find conclusive evidence of extraterrestrial life in the universe, there will be a predictable international debate about whether and how to react. How do we prepare for this debate? How do we anticipate and plan for the communication SETI has been seeking for decades, or for any other evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence, for that matter? Bet that Oumuamua was an exotic rock and nothing more, and on the day that more such evidence presents itself clearly, we will scramble to construct the necessary tools. The first will probably be the academic field of astrolinguistics to confront the challenge of an intergalactic means of communication. Other fields would follow, such as astropolitics, astroeconomics, astrosociology, astropsychology, and so on. Bet that Oumuamua was of alien technology origin, however, and we could start tomorrow to establish such fields. There are other relatively unambitious bets we could make on Oumuamua's alien technology origins. For instance, upon discovering conclusively that we are not alone in the universe, we will also quickly discover that existing terrestrial international law provides us no thought-out framework to respond to an extraterrestrial encounter. Indeed, among the most modest of all optimistic bets that humanity could place on Oumuamua being of alien technology origin would be the establishment of international protocols and oversight, likely under the umbrella of the United Nations, regarding our efforts to search for and find evidence of extraterrestrial life and communicate with extraterrestrial intelligence. Even a nascent treaty agreed to by all terrestrial signatories would provide a framework for how we as a species respond to an encounter with a mature intelligence that is billions of years more advanced than we are. What would be the most ambitious wager humanity could place on Oumuamua? It would be something sufficient to ensure terrestrial life's survival. A more ambitious bet would be to learn from what we imagine a more mature civilization might have attempted, to take the small scientific leap and allow the possibility Oumuamua was extraterrestrial technology is to give humanity the small nudge toward thinking like a civilization that could have left a light sail buoy for our solar system to run into. It is to nudge us not just to imagine alien spacecraft, but to contemplate the construction of our own such craft. Alien spacecraft might include robots equipped with 3D printers and artificial intelligence, which would allow them to use raw materials they scooped up elsewhere to make artificial objects based on blueprints from their home planet. This serves the purpose of avoiding catastrophes at one location by making copies of the same precious content at other locations. The advantage of 3D printing of life from raw materials on a target planet is that natural biological systems with DNA as we know it live a finite lifetime. Even the most cautiously stored building blocks of life may disintegrate in a few million years. Machinery capable of constructing life once it reaches its destination can last much longer. Perhaps we should be working along the same lines even before we obtain conclusive evidence that we are not the only or even the most intelligent life in the universe. As a child, I would search for the spherical seed heads of dandelions, bring them up to my face, and blow as hard as I could. Just as nature intended, the seeds scattered far and wide. 2 weeks later, I would see new seedlings pushing up from the soil. Could civilizations preserve themselves from extinction by doing something similar? Might extraterrestrial civilizations have already tried? And could this also be a way to preserve life in the universe? Recall Oumuamua's slight deviation from the path explicable by the gravity of the sun alone. Something else pushed it. And I have hypothesized that this something else was the force of sunlight on an extraterrestrial light sail. But even assuming the object to have been optimally designed for this purpose, it deviated only slightly. The reason is that the force of the sun is barely capable of accelerating a light sail craft to just a thousandth of the speed of light, even if it starts its journey as close as 10 times the solar radius, which is the closest we have yet managed to send a craft, the Parker Solar Probe, the robotic spacecraft launched in 2018 to study the corona of the sun. We would need a far greater force to propel our seeds of terrestrial life in sufficient number and across the universe. Something less like the radiation of our sun, and more like a star exploding in a supernova. An exploding star would have a luminosity equivalent to a billion suns shining for a month. A light sail weighing less than half a gram per square meter could, propelled by such an explosion, reach almost the speed of light, even if it were separated from the exploding star by 100 times the distance of the Earth from the Sun. This would allow our Dandelion craft to reach regions of the universe of which we currently can only dream, thereby dramatically expanding the number of possible planets where the seeds of life might find a home. To picture how this might work in practice, imagine a civilization that resides near Eta Carina, a massive star with a luminosity 5 million times that of the Sun. To ensure the continuation of life, it could park numerous light sails around the star and cleverly await the explosion that would launch these sails to almost the speed of light at minimal cost. Such a civilization would have reached a level of either patience or profligacy that humanity hasn't yet. Massive stars live for millions of years, and the exact timing of their explosion is difficult to forecast. Eta Carina, for example, has a lifetime of a few million years. Predicting its death to the precision of millennia is the equivalent of forecasting anyone's death to within a year after approaching the average life expectancy. Such a civilization would also have had to plan ahead to a degree humanity has never proven capable. While its light sails could be transported to their destination around the aging star well in advance of the explosion using cheap chemical rockets, the journey could take millions of years using that primitive mode of propulsion. But it is forethought and patience that present the greatest obstacles. The technology, while formidable, is achievable. We know from our modeling for Starshot that sails must be highly reflective so as not to absorb too much heat and burn up. We can also anticipate how to build such craft to avoid the danger of them being pushed away by the bright starlight prior to the explosion, and to keep these craft from accelerating into paths strewn with stellar debris, they should be designed to fold into needle-like configurations to minimize damage and friction and greatly increase the number of such craft. It would be a civilization's greatest of hedged bets. Conceivably numbering in the trillions, these small light sail craft built to preserve the building blocks of life could sit like dormant seeds a tremendous distance from an aging massive star awaiting the inevitable. Even if the civilization that placed them there failed to outrun its great filter, on going supernova, the star would disperse into the universe the possibility for the continuation of life, just like the seeds of a dandelion do. Of course, there is no need to be that patient. It is already technologically feasible for humanity to use powerful lasers that will be far more effective than the sun to push light sails out into interstellar space. This, of course, is the centerpiece proposal of the Breakthrough Starshot initiative. A laser beam that produced 10 gigawatts of power per square meter would be 10 million times brighter than sunlight on Earth and able to send light sail craft at several tenths the speed of light. Without question, this would require a major investment. But the moment we know that we are not alone, that we are almost certainly not the most advanced civilization ever to have existed in the cosmos, we will realize that we've spent more funds developing the means to destroy all life on the planet than it would have cost to try to preserve it. Confronted with the Oumuamua wager, we might conclude that humanity's continued existence is worth the expense. Currently, we keep all our eggs in one basket, the Earth. As a result, humanity and our civilization are extremely vulnerable to catastrophe. By spreading multiple copies of our genetic material through the universe, we could guard against that risk. This effort would resemble the revolution brought about by the invention of the printing press, which allowed Johannes Gutenberg to mass-produce copies of the Bible and distribute them throughout Europe. As soon as many copies of the book were made, any single copy lost its unique value as a precious entity. In the same way, as soon as we learn how to produce synthetic life in our laboratories, Gutenberg DNA printers could be distributed to make copies of the human genome out of raw materials on the surface of other planets. No single copy would be essential for preserving our species' genetic information. Rather, that information would be contained in multiple copies. As I write, colleagues of mine at Harvard and elsewhere are working diligently to move the miracle of creating life into the column of mundane accomplishments. Much as physics benefited greatly from laboratory experiments that unraveled the laws that govern the universe, these scientists are attempting to create synthetic life in the laboratory and unravel the multitude of chemical paths that could give birth to life. For example, the Shostak Laboratory, headed by its namesake, Nobel laureate Jack Shostak, is building a synthetic cellular system that evolves, replicates itself, and preserves genetic information according to the mechanisms outlined by Charles Darwin in 1859. Shostak and his team are focused on creating a protocell capable of replication and variation, which means it should be able to evolve. They hope this will lead to the spontaneous emergence of genomically encoded catalysts and structured molecules. If it works, this accomplishment would guide us toward the best celestial targets in our astronomical search for life by showing us under which conditions life can emerge. But it might also teach us more about our own selves as life forms, and give us a much-needed dose of humility in the process. Consider that cookbooks are full of recipes that have the same ingredients but result in different cakes, depending on the timing and fashion in which these ingredients are mixed and heated. Some cakes taste better than others. There is no reason to expect that terrestrial life, which emerged under random circumstances on Earth, was optimal. There may be other paths leading to better cakes. The prospect of humanity producing synthetic life in the laboratory also raises interesting questions about our own origins. Are we the result of exclusively terrestrial evolution? Or did we, like the protocells being developed in university laboratories, receive a helping nudge? In 1871, in an address before the British Association for the Advancement of Science, the prolific physicist and mathematician Lord Kelvin suggested that life could have come to Earth by way of traveling meteorites. The idea wasn't original to Lord Kelvin. Ancient Greeks entertained the idea, and decades before Lord Kelvin's address, other European scientists had given the possibility scrutiny. But despite the interest in the 19th century, following Kelvin's presentation to the association in 1871, the idea went ignored for another century. Over the past two decades, however, the theory of panspermia, the idea that life might reach habitable planets by way of meteorites, comets, or stardust, has been gaining more rigorous attention as scientific research confirmed the hypothesis that certain meteorites discovered on Earth were of Martian origin. Once we began to seek these Martian meteorites, we found many more of them. We learned that ALH84001, a Martian meteorite that was found in Antarctica in 1984, had never been heated above 40 degrees Celsius, 104 degrees Fahrenheit, after being ejected from the surface of Mars. To date, over 100 such Martian landers have been identified. If there was ever life on the red planet, clearly it has had opportunities to reach Earth and survive. Adding to the intrigue is the fact that scientific consensus has it that Earth was uninhabitable until about 4 billion years ago, and yet we have found evidence of life dating back 3.8 billion years. How is it possible, scientists asked, for Darwinian evolution to have so quickly produced DNA-based life? We know from terrestrial biology that life is self-serving. Selective and spontaneous adaptations that increase life's ability to persevere is the bedrock of Darwinian biology. Life's aim is survival, which means propagation. How plausible is it that life would make use of panspermia to spread and secure its survival. In 2018, my postdocs Idan Ginsberg and Manasvi Lingam and I published a paper entitled Galactic Panspermia, in which we presented an analytical model to estimate the total number of rocky or icy objects that could be captured by planetary systems within the Milky Way galaxy and result in panspermia should they harbor life. We first considered whether we might be Martians. For life on Earth to be descended from life on Mars, the red planet would have to have been hit by an asteroid or comet with sufficient force that material was ejected into interplanetary space, and that material would have had to find its way to Earth. And crucially, any life aboard would have had to survive the interplanetary voyage as well as the ejection and landing. Mars has indeed been struck trillions of times by space debris larger than a person over the billions of years of its existence. Many impacts have resulted in temperatures and shock pressures guaranteed to kill any building blocks of life still clinging to the ejected rocks. But, as with the Martian meteorite ALH84001, some ejected materials did not exceed the boiling temperature of water, allowing some microorganisms to survive. This means that were there Martian life, it would still be living on rocks tossed into space by these gentler impacts. Scientists estimate that Mars has ejected billions of such fragments, objects with low enough temperatures to allow life to survive. But even if the microorganisms survive their ejection from Mars, how plausible is it that they could survive the trip? There has been lively debate on this point, especially over how lethal ultraviolet radiation is to bacteria. But radio-resistant bacteria with extreme tolerance to ultraviolet radiation and ionization have been discovered, and these strains could survive such a trip. In fact, some terrestrial bacteria exhibit such extreme tolerances to UV and radiation that it is likely they originated on Mars. What's more, the hypothetical pool of surviving bacteria increases if we posit they're traveling within a meteorite or comet in a way that shields them from UV radiation. Such a rocky shielding could be as thin as just a few centimeters. And other studies have proven that spores of the bacteria Bacillus subtilis can survive in space for up to 6 years. Other bacteria could live for vastly longer stretches of time, measurable in millions of years. Further, scientists have hypothesized a colony of bacteria that's able to surround itself with a biofilm that greatly increases the organism's protection from harmful radiation. In another paper, my undergraduate student Amir Siraj and I calculated that bacteria floating in the Earth's atmosphere could have been scooped up by grazing objects that passed just 50 kilometers above sea level and then escaped the solar system. Such an interstellar space-bound object would resemble a spoon passing through the foam on top of a cappuccino, only in this instance it would continue on with a residue of terrestrial life. We found that billions of such spoons have stirred the Earth's atmosphere over the planet's lifetime. Would the bacteria have survived the trip? It is well known that fighter pilots can barely survive maneuvers with accelerations exceeding 10 Gs, where G is the gravitational acceleration that binds us to Earth. But Earth-grazing objects would scoop up microbes at accelerations of millions of Gs. Could they live through the jolt? Possibly. Microbes such as Bacillus subtilis, Caenorhabditis elegans, Deinococcus radiodurans, Escherichia coli, and Paracoccus dinitrificans have been shown to live through accelerations just one order of magnitude smaller. As it turns out, these mini-astronauts are far better suited for taking a space ride than our very best human pilots. They could survive the impact on Earth's surface as long as their deep interiors were not overheated, similar to the Martian rock ALH84001. This data tells us we cannot dismiss the possibility that we are of Martian origin. But might we be even more exotic? Might the truly original source of life on Earth, whether or not by way of a Martian layover, be interstellar or intergalactic? Yes. After conducting a rigorous analysis of the viability of panspermia, my colleagues and I determined that there is a parameter space that allows the galaxy to be saturated with life-bearing objects. While objects with lower velocities are more likely to be captured by the gravitational pull of a planet, and given the established fact that some bacteria can survive millions of years, we estimated that the probability of a life-bearing object striking a planet was significant. Indeed, by positing gravitational scattering events at the galactic center of the Milky Way, we projected that rocky material could be ejected at such extreme velocities that the center could have seeded the entire galaxy. Those seeds need not even be restricted to bacteria. Certain viruses, which are also capable of Darwinian evolution, have proven themselves sufficiently durable. Even more complicated life might make the trip. Indeed, two roundworms discovered in the Arctic permafrost were revived after being in cryobiosis when metabolic processes stop for an estimated 30 to 40,000 years. If organisms such as these could survive the kinds of conditions and timescales that they might encounter on an interplanetary voyage, who's to say they themselves aren't descended from Martians? Here is where the right bet on Oumuamua's wager could pay immediate dividends. Gamble that we have already seen evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence, and both the questions we ask and the projects we undertake shift. Consider that every scientific contortion we've just taken to arrive at the higher probability of naturally occurring panspermia is simplified if we entertain directed panspermia. How to ensure life is safely ejected from a planet? Eject it yourself. How to ensure life is sufficiently protected from the harms of space while traveling between planets or galaxies? Build a rocket to the purpose. How to make sure life is nurtured and preserved to survive the extremely long journeys among galaxies? Build your rocket to that purpose, too. Much depends on how we respond to Oumuamua's wager. The safest bet is to deem the object a peculiar rock, nothing more, and stick to our familiar habits of thought. But when so much is at stake, safe bets can only get us so far. If we dare to wager that Oumuamua was a piece of advanced extraterrestrial technology, we stand only to gain. Whether it prompts us to methodically search the universe for signs of life or to undertake more ambitious technological projects, placing an optimistic bet could have a transformative effect on our civilization. If humanity is able to think, plan, and build in pursuit of a vision measurable in millions of years, we just might manage to ensure that life in the universe is able to ride out the vast challenges of time and space by riding the flash of light from an exploding star. When I think of this familiar technology in that way, a light sail tumbling in sunlight resembles nothing so much as the wings of a dandelion seed sent off by the wind to fertilize virgin soil. Which brings us back to life originating in laboratories. Take the more cautious approach to Oumuamua's wager, and we celebrate this extraordinary accomplishment solely for its implications for biomedical research. Take the more ambitious approach to Oumuamua's wager, and creating synthetic life in the laboratory becomes, potentially, a means for terrestrial life to outrun the great filter, even after the inevitable death of the sun. There is no doubt that if our civilization is bold enough and lasts long enough, we will eventually migrate into space and into new regions of the universe that in essential ways resemble our current one. In doing so, we will surely be following in the footsteps of those who came before us. Just as ancient civilizations migrated toward banks of rivers on Earth, advanced technological civilizations likely migrate throughout the universe toward environments that are rich in resources, from habitable planets to clusters of galaxies. But no civilizations, very much including our own, will make the leap to migrating out among the stars if they are not smart enough to preserve their home planets while they plan and prepare. And it is an achievement humanity is less likely to attain when so many of us cling to the uniqueness of terrestrial life, like that ant clung to that grain of sand.